Welcome to Holden Village.
Today is the 4th of August, 1995.
In the fireside room this afternoon,
our speaker is Gail Eifrig,
and she will be speaking on literary feasts, healing.
So let's listen in on Gail.
As I had said, and as you can see from the front page of the handout, my approach to doing this has been to think about feasting and to explore what feasting might mean and how we could sort of shake up some of our notions about feasting by getting at that concept in different ways from literary texts. And I've sort of sorted out in a kind of artificial way, I think, this schematic or list of topics that would break down or would get at feasting by showing how it meets certain human needs. Feasting meets our needs for community, intimacy, abundance. We have talked about those this week in a number of different texts, and that I wanted to talk all the time about Babette's Feast and Wind in the Willows, and then also throw in some others now and then, which I have made selections of. So some of those selections are in front of you, and I really do hope to get to Like Water for Chocolate and Beloved at some time this evening, and I'm sure those of you who read through the sections are anxious to do that too, but I hope that you don't think that I'm going to have some kind of ultimate answer on the meaning of those passages. I am just as eager to hear what you have to contribute to my understanding of those two rather difficult texts. At least they're difficult in different ways, but problematic texts. So rather than start with the hard stuff... Oh, good. If I don't have a fly tonight, I'll be delighted. I had to be rescued last night by a person with fewer inhibitions than I. Saw me suffering from a fly and just came straight up and smacked it dead on my back so that I wouldn't be bothered because I was just going like this and driving everyone crazy. I found a wonderful passage in Wind in the Willows today that, I mean, I have read this book a million times. Well, that might be a slight exaggeration. But I had never known how absolutely wonderfully this passage would fit into a list that says that we can think about the ways in which feasting meets a need for healing. And I think there are a number of texts that one can use to talk about that, and certainly Babette's Feast would just fit in there in great big letters, but we have spent a lot of time talking about Babette's Feast, and we can get to some others. But this passage from Wind in the Willows is, I think, has just some wonderful stuff in it, which I hope that as I read through it, or those of you who have done the right thing and bought your copy at the bookstore, only, what does it cost? $2.95. I chose a really cheap edition on purpose, so that you could buy it. And John tells me he still has a few copies, so I want you to run right in there. But anyway, I'm going to read this, if you will indulge me in that. And what I want you to be doing is listening for the elements of feasting, which you have demonstrated to me so marvelously in the last few days. You do brilliantly. And here's a new passage for you to do it with. In this section, which follows the early picnic that we had last night, Mole has decided to strike out on his own, and he has heard this wonderful call from the natural world, and he wants to go out and explore it by himself. He's now feeling so brave in his new manifestation as an independent person who can just do exciting things. So although the animals have told him never to go to the wildwood, he does that. And of course he hasn't been there very long when he runs into trouble and is very frightened. And there's a whole sequence of passages here that describes various ways that persons get frightened. And I think for children this is recognizable, but it doesn't take very long reading this to recover your own sense of childhood fright, being in a place that is unfamiliar and that gradually begins to feel hostile. And as this passage goes on, we have a piece and another piece and another piece with an intensification of Mole's feeling of desperate fright. The pattering increased till it sounded like sudden hail on the dry leaf carpet spread around him. The whole wood seemed running now, running hard, hunting, chasing, closing in round something or somebody. In panic, he began to run too, aimlessly, he knew not whither. He ran up against things, he fell over things and into things, he darted under things and dodged round things. At last he took refuge in the deep, dark hollow of an old beech tree, which offered shelter, concealment, perhaps even safety, but who could tell? Anyway, he was too tired to run any further and could only snuggle down into the dry leaves which had drifted into the hollow and hope he was safe there for the time. As he lay there, panting and trembling, and listened to the whistlings and the patterings outside, he knew it at last in all its fullness, that dread thing which other little dwellers in field and hedgerow had encountered here and known as their darkest moment, that thing which the rat had vainly tried to shield him from, the terror of the wild wood. Well, he exists there in terror by himself for a while, and finally is found by Rat, who has also by instinct known his friend was in trouble and gone out after him. But as they're working their way through the wild wood, it begins, it's snowing, and the storm gathers force and gets worse and worse. So he is found by Ratty, but then the two of them have got to face this terror together, a terror which keeps getting worse and more threatening. The rat crept into the hollow, and there he found the mole, exhausted and still trembling. "Oh, rat," he cried, "I have been so frightened, you can't think." "Oh, I quite understand," said the rat soothingly. "You shouldn't really have gone and done it, mole. I did my best to keep you from it. We river bankers, we hardly ever come here by ourselves. If we have to come, we come in couples at least, then we're generally all right. Besides, there are 100 things one has to know which we understand all about and you don't as yet. I mean passwords, signs and sayings which have power and effect, and plants you carry in your pocket and verses you repeat and dodges and tricks you practice, all simple enough when you know them, but they've got to be known if you're small or you'll find yourself in trouble. Of course, if you were badger or otter, it would be quite another matter." I love that paragraph. As I was reading it today, I thought of Lutheran liturgy. Passwords, signs, and sayings which have power and effect, and plants you carry in your pocket. I don't know, did you do plants you carry in your pocket? But here's Mole out in the wild wood by himself, frightened. Now found by Rat, but now the two of them, although Rat is more confident, they're in a bad way. The storm has gotten worse, they're tireder. They're at the far extent of their energy and their knowledge. It's snowing hard. So they then walk on, but they're tireder and the weather is worse. And so there seemed to be no end to this wood and no beginning and no difference in it. And worst of all, no way out. Well, they decide that rather than get down into a little sort of bunker, they'll go on. So once more, they got on their feet and struggled down into the dell where they hunted about for a cave or some corner that was dry and a protection from the keen wind and the whirling snow. They were investigating one of the hummocky bits the rat had spoken of when suddenly the mole tripped up and fell forward on his face with a squeal. I identified strongly with having fallen badly on a trail the other day. "Oh, my leg," he cried. "Oh, my poor shin." And he sat up on the snow and nursed his leg in both his front paws. "Poor old mole," said the rat kindly. "You don't seem to be having much luck today, do you? Let's have a look at the leg." "Yes," he went on, going down on his knees to look, "you've cut your shin, sure enough. Wait till I get my handkerchief, and I'll tie it up for you." "I must have tripped over a hidden branch or a stump," said the mole miserably. "Oh my, oh my." And we hear the echo of the "oh my," which is mole's typical thing, but we've heard it before as an exclamation of such delight, and now it's, well, "it's a very clear cut," said the rat, examining it again attentively. "That was never done by a branch or a stump. Looks as if it was made by a sharp edge of something in metal. Funny." He pondered a while and examined the humps and slopes that surrounded them. "Well, never mind what done it," said the mole, forgetting his grammar in his pain. "It hurts just the same, whatever done it." Well, the rat, of course, is diligent and intent. And, of course, what he finds by scraping away at the snow in the area is a doorstop. A doorstop means a house, and finally they find that they find a little door in a bank with a door painted green and a brass nameplate beside the door that says Mr. Badger. So they have not been found, but have found the badger's house. There was a noise of a bolt shot back, and the door opened a few inches, enough to show a long snout and a pair of sleepy, blinking eyes. "Now, the very next time this happens," said a gruff and suspicious voice, "I shall be exceedingly angry. Who is it this time disturbing people on such a night? Speak up." That should really be Walt's lines to read. "Oh, Badger," cried the rat, "let us in, please. It's me, Rat, and my friend Mole, and we've lost our way in the snow." "What, Ratty, my dear little man," exclaimed the Badger in quite a different voice. "Come along in, both of you, at once. Why, you must be perished. Well, I never, lost in the snow, and in the wildwood, too, at this time of night. But come in with you." The two animals tumbled over each other in their eagerness to get inside and heard the door shut behind them with great joy and relief. So they now are down in the badger's den, in the safe, warm, and they go through the passageways, and this is the kitchen. The floor was well-worn red brick, and on the wide hearth burnt a fire of logs between two attractive chimney corners tucked away in the wall, well out of any suspicion of draft. A couple of high-backed settles facing each other on either side of the fire gave further sitting accommodation for the sociably disposed. That reminded me of Holden with its many sitting places for the sociably disposed. In the middle of the room stood a long table of plain boards placed on trestles with benches down each side. At one end of it, where an armchair stood pushed back, there spread the remains of the badger's plain but ample supper. Rows of spotless plates winked from the shelves of the dresser at the far end of the room, and from the rafters overhead hung hams, bundles of dried herbs, nets of onions, and baskets of eggs. It seemed a place where heroes could fitly feast after victory, where weary harvesters could line up in scores along the table and keep their harvest home with mirth and song, or where two or three friends of simple taste could sit about as they pleased and eat and smoke and talk in comfort and contentment. The ruddy brick floor smiled up at the smoky ceiling. The oaken settles, shiny with long wear, exchanged cheerful glances with each other. Plates on the dresser grinned at pots on the shelf, and the merry firelight flickered and played over everything without distinction. Now, the kindly badger thrust them down on a settle to toast themselves at the fire and bade them remove their wet coats and boots. Then he fetched them dressing gowns and slippers, and himself bathed the mole's shin with warm water and mended the cut with sticking plaster till the whole thing was just as good as new, if not better. In the embracing light and warmth, warm and dry at last, with weary legs propped up in front of them and a suggestive clink of plates being arranged on the table behind, it seemed to the storm-driven animals, now in safe anchorage, that the cold and trackless wildwood just left outside was miles and miles away, and all that they had suffered in it a half-forgotten dream. When at last they were thoroughly toasted, the badger summoned them to the table, where he had been busy laying a repast. They had felt pretty hungry before, but when they actually saw at last the supper that was spread for them, really it seemed only a question of what they should attack first, where all was so attractive, and whether the other things would obligingly wait for them till they had time to give them attention. Conversation was impossible for a long time, and when it was slowly resumed, it was that regrettable sort of conversation that results from talking with your mouth full. The badger did not mind that sort of thing at all, nor did he take any notice of elbows on the table or everybody speaking at once. As he did not go into society himself, he had got an idea that these things belonged to the things that didn't really matter. We know, of course, that he was wrong and took too narrow a view, because they do matter very much, though it would take too long to explain why. He sat in his armchair at the head of the table and nodded gravely at intervals as the animals told their story, and he did not seem surprised or shocked at anything, and he never said, "I told you so," or "just what I always said," or remarked that they ought to have done so and so, or ought not to have done something else. The mole began to feel very friendly towards him. When supper was really finished at last, and each animal felt that his skin was now as tight as was decently safe, and that by this time he didn't care a hang for anybody or anything, they gathered round the glowing embers of the great wood fire and thought how jolly it was to be sitting up so late and so independent and so full. And after they had chatted for a time about things in general, the badger said heartily, "Now then, tell us the news from your part of the world," etc. Have to go on with the rest of it yourself. But I could hardly contain myself as I read that over this afternoon. I wanted to go running around and find some of you and say, look what I just said. As all of these wonderful things are here now, and especially, what would you guess that I starred in my text?
Besides the fall.
What? Besides the fall. But connected with the fall. What happens before this supper begins? Yes, the host kneels down on the floor and washes the leg and the injury of his guest. I thought this when I read that today, and here I had read this a million times and had never noticed that. I thought, wow, that's much cooler than I would have thought. There's that touch in itself. What other things set up this feast to be a feast? What are the components of it that show us a feast as healing event? That one is, the most obvious, and it's really right there, in this badger den. They're just underneath it a little way, and yet it seems to them worlds away. So it's another one of those occasions where the way in which it is perceived is what determines the kind of reality of the event. I love the phrase that Sue, is it, used. They went in broken and came out whole. Part of what makes this feast so feasting is their condition beforehand, which it's around. I don't seem to be able to do anything about it. They are, and Graham is at some pains, and there's a lot that I didn't read you, the section that describes just how lost and how cold and how frightened they are is much longer than I read. So that in a sense, these are disproportionate pieces of reading. He spends a lot of time on how at risk and damaged they are by the wild wood, which I think in itself is suggestive. There's a wide difference between the wild wood, which is so strange and terrifying, and every detail of this kitchen is to make it seem as comforting and comfortable, and it's every element of home.
Something else that they benefited from was the wholehearted welcome that they got when the door was open.
Yes, which we as readers don't expect, nor Mole either, though probably Ratty does. Yes.
Along with that, it was serendipity to the discovery of this badger's den,
right.
Kind of a joyful surprise to close things out with. Although it was a little painful for the Mole, I guess.
That in itself may be instructive, right? If we're going to have the surprises that save us, we may need to trip over them, or we, you know, the part of what sweetens the joy of the occasion is its contrast from what happened. And even in the finding of the place, there has been this painful accident.
I mean, if Ratty hadn't been so persistent in finding out what he got cut on, they wouldn't have found the door anyhow.
And that's another thing that I didn't read as much as there is, because Ratty does have to be persistent. Mole thinks he's being ridiculous.
He's hurt. Leave me alone.
Yes. That this can't possibly offer them anything real. They ought to go and try to do something meaningful. Why just stand here scratching around in the snow and wandering around, pacing things around and looking at the bank, which Ratty does a lot. So he has the persistence, I suppose, and the discipline to continue with his knowledge about what he at least suspects, whereas Mole is too frightened to do for himself at that point.
Well,
you haven't said anything.
Okay. There was also a freedom to do when they were in the woods.
Yes, that's a wonderful point, because their knowledge of themselves is not as strong away from the table as before. And about rules, this is a rather free enterprise, this feast. There is enough about it which is, should one say, traditional, to allow them to know what's happening. I like that little detail about the comforting clink of dishes being put on the table. They don't have to see what's happening to know that a preparation, I mean, they know what the preparation is. They know what those are the signs of. So they recognize signs, and that helps them to know, to anticipate, to know what will happen.
What's the phrase, comforting or suggestive thinking? There was one word.
Suggestion.
Was there? Anyway, I was struck by, at one point, that adjective, the suggestive thinking. I thought it was but maybe it was a comforting.
A suggestive clink of plates being arranged on the table behind. And that's the last detail that is given right before the sentence about it. A suggestive clink of plates being arranged on the table behind, it seemed to the storm-driven animals that the cold and trackless wood. They only need these signs of the feast to come, that because they are in the state they're in, and because of the welcome they've had, because that and the very look of the kitchen itself. Notice that Graham is shameless in animating inanimate objects. He talks about the plates smiling to each other and the furniture sort of creating this atmosphere of jolly. Well, we all know that's stupid, right? But that is a another one of those indications that it is the way that something strikes you, not some sort of objective reality. It is the world animated by your own imagination or your own sense of what it is, what it means, that gives you the experience or the reality.
There's something about Badger's welcome too that, as it were, sort of puts the switches the on button and these things. A part of that welcoming, joyful atmosphere the kitchen radiates is a part of Badger's hospitality too. And,
That strikes me as I listen, knowing a little bit about the habits of moles and rats, I can see how they sort of fit the description in this story.
Oh,
I haven't seen that yet with respect to Badger, but I think the choice of rat and mole are
good
very appropriate.
Well, and badger probably would strike you more that way too in the book, more of its totality. This scene is where we happen to see him being sort of warm and cozy and inviting. His reputation is that he's quite set apart, rather solitary, doesn't like other people much and stays away from them, and does things on his own terms. That, you know, you come to him and he will decide whether to let you in or not, but he's not, like Rat, hospitable to one and all, open home, you know, this kind of thing. You have to find Badger with difficulty. He comes and goes according to his own schedule. He may be there or he may not.
But as soon as he knew it was Rat, then he welcomed.
Yes. There again, entirely, you know, on his own terms. It's he provides this feast in a very warm and generous way, but he is badgery to that extent that he, you know, he is he's differentiated from good going, Kathy. He's differentiated from the other characters. Yes.
Which reminds me of some people that I've known that have been really shy, and you think that they are aloof and distant and uncaring or have their own terms and don't really want to fit in, but once you get to know them, you find out they are just shy, they're not aloof, and once you're in their space, they're very warm and open up, but they can't necessarily do it in a large. Mm-hmm.
They have their own terms for
it. Right. So you get to know people.
Did you hear that little detail about the kitchen? That it was suitable for, it would have been the perfect table for heroes to celebrate victory.
For threshers coming back.
What?
Also for threshers?
Yes, for the harvest home. Those two significant human feasts. It seemed a place where heroes could fitly feast after victory. Notice on the last item on my list of closure lists the Lord of the Rings, and I would always see that scene of the great final feast in the Lord of the Rings as a kind of the epitome of feast banquet, feasting banquets after victory. Also, I wrote in one of these things, Beowulf, I would put at least one of the feasts in Beowulf in that category also. But here, too, Graham pulls in that kind of heroic dimension of feasting. And then the old traditional English version of feasting, the Harvest Home Festival, where when the harvest was in, then the whole household, all the way from the top to the bottom, has this big feast in a barn, in the barn usually, or in one of the farm buildings, and that too is brought in here as two manifestations that the look of the kitchen presents to these strangers. So they both have to do with being in the place where you want to be, the place of fulfillment, the place that is complete, where some significant activity has come to a successful conclusion. And that seems kind of grandiose for these little creatures in the wood. That is, we're just dealing here in the story with these little creatures. Graham's way of kind of impressing us with the significance of this very small event is to show it in the lens of those two long histories in culture of significant victory dinners. Well, I suppose significant victory dinners could turn us to like water for chocolate. The section that I have put in the handout is a long one. Strikes me as having many wonderful and odd, well, of course, the whole book is wonderful and odd. Book, it certainly has a lot to do with feasting, though the feasts are in a completely different...
What page is that on?
Oh, it's number 10, I think, so it's about 3 from the end, or 4 from the end. Is it page 23? Up, it's a page that looks like that. Long columns like this.
Yeah, page 23.
Just a couple of things that I would point out. This section, describes, you know, narrates a dinner at which untoward events happen. And of course, they're wonderful. We could have put this not under intimacy, perhaps. Well, maybe under intimacy. Certainly under abundance. There are a lot of, and certainly also under sensuousness, the very the exercise of all the senses are certainly what this author, what Laura Esquivel is working with in this wonderful but strange and exotic feast. Notice that this section, which I believe is, this is most of a chapter, and I should have written down what chapter. I don't think I did. Oops, that's on my second page. No, it doesn't. I didn't say what chapter. But this is most of a chapter, and of course it is either followed or preceded, I can't remember how that book works, by the recipe for these quail with a rose petal sauce. So I must say I'd be a little hesitant to try it. No matter how wonderful it is. I'm not sure I'm ready for an experience like this chapter counts. But it begins, note, and I here's a kind of maybe some neat connections with Babette even. Tita was the last link in a chain of cooks who had been passing culinary secrets from generation to generation since ancient times, and she was considered the finest exponent of the marvelous art of cooking. The marvelous art, and I certainly marvelous is a word that this writer leans on heavily, and in that she's sort of working a little bit, I think, out of that magic realism category of South American and Hispanic contemporary literature. But this section, which has to do with a marvelous meal, a meal at which strange things happen, because of, in a way, I think, because of the relationship of the cook to the feast itself, to the food itself, to the physical realities of those things, which not only are themselves, but take on all kinds of other meaning. And maybe one of the strongest places that we, or one of the most immediate places is that we see this. This episode begins when Tita, who is the sister that the mother has decided will not get married, but will stay at home with her to take care of her, the mother. And so although Tita is madly in love with Pedro, and also Pedro is madly in love with her, Pedro is married to someone else. But as this section begins, what?
To her sister.
Pedro thinks it would be nice to bring her a bouquet of roses to celebrate her first year as a ranch cook. But no one else thinks this is nice, because the mother, as soon as she sees those roses, sent Tita away to get rid of the roses. Now too late, Pedro realized his foolhardiness. Again with a look, Mama Elena informed him there was still time to repair the damage. Such a look it was, that he excused himself and went off to look for Rosara, his wife. Tita clasped the roses to her chest so tightly that when she got to the kitchen, the roses, which had been mostly pink, had turned quite red from the blood that was flowing from Tita's hands and breasts. She had to think fast what to do with them. They were beautiful. She couldn't just throw them in the trash. In the first place, she'd never been given flowers before, and second, they were from Pedro. All at once, she seemed to hear Naka's voice dictating a recipe, a pre-Hispanic recipe involving rose petals. Tita had nearly forgotten it because it called for pheasants, which they didn't raise on the ranch. Well, she decides that she can make it with quail, so she makes this substitution. Then, of course, she has to kill the little baby quail, which causes her no end of grief. And there is another one of the identifications. First, we have the identification of her with the roses, that her blood and the roses combine to change the roses. And then, when she is trying to kill these quail, she has one and she partly has choked it, but she hasn't been stern enough with it, and so it's still living and in pain. So to spare the quail the pain she felt, Tita, we can't not read that. She realized that you can't be weak when it comes to killing. You have to be strong, or it just causes more sorrow. It occurred to her that she could use her mother's strength right now. Mama Elena was merciless, killing with a single blow. But then again, not always. For Tita, she had made an exception. She had been killing her a little at a time since she was a child, and she still hadn't quite finished her off. Pedro and Rosara's marriage had left Tita broken in both heart and in mind, like the quail. To spare the quail the pain she felt, Tita moved sharply and decisively, finishing him off as an act of mercy. With the others, it was easier. She just pretended that each quail had a soft-boiled egg stuck in its crop and that she was delivering it from this suffering, mercifully, by giving its neck a good twist. As a child, she would have chosen death over those soft-boiled eggs she was made to eat. Mama Elena forced them on her. She would feel her throat tighten so tight she couldn't swallow any kind of food until her mother gave her a smack that miraculously loosened the knot in her throat. Then the egg slid down without any problem. Feeling calmer, she had no difficulty in completing the next step. Well, it doesn't take huge leaps of imagination to see Esquivel making us aware that Tita is identified with the food she's going to cook. It is her body that she works with as the material for the feast. It's transformed as her blood has transformed the roses, and she and the quail are just so wonderfully identified in that passage that seems so kind of simple and yet is so both terrible and powerful.
Well, the term that threads through this is the tragedy of it all, with the tragedy of tradition,
mm-hmm.
because and the food and the feasting is the tradition that becomes the tragedy for all the years, because she vents everything through her cooking,
mm-hmm.
and her feeling of cooking and her sock. That's the way only way she can vent through this. And of course she's been around it as a young child.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
That theme of tragedy all the way through, and the quail, the killing of the quail in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
The flowers is symbolic to her feelings that are venting through these incredible meals. Anger.
Well, yes, I think that that's true. It is a tragedy for her. I mean, I think that as we...
But no, it's the tragedy of her. But it's also a question of the book, the tragedy of that ridiculous tradition that the first daughter will take care of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
But you, well, that's okay.
I was just going to say that the feast becomes the healing part of that, because it's the way that she loves passionately and deeply, and she does love Pedro through her cooking. Mm-hmm. So that's a place that she has access to give to him. It's selfish.
That's certainly one of the things that seems very powerful about it to me. It's not certainly the sorrow that is really quintessential in Tita's life, and it is portrayed as sorrowful even in this passage also, not only in the section I just read, but all the way through, and even at the end where she's trying to do even a kind of miraculous identification with her sister Gertrudis and can't make contact with her. I mean, there is a sense in which this character is always trying to connect and to make the identification of herself with others, which is always cut off at every point. At every point except in her cooking, where it seems to me, and maybe I may not be right about this, but the cooking and the meals are her way of redeeming that sorrow. It something good is made out of all that. Oh, I think, yes, the book is, as a whole, is a tremendous examination of the bitter sorrow of women's lives and men's lives in a society where certain people's cruelty, and I think Mama Elena is cruel, is allowed by the tradition to dominate every relationship. And that is an almost irremediable sorrow about human life. In a way, this is a picture of all of human life and its sorrow, particularly under the power of cruelty represented by tradition or authorized by tradition. But this writer's way of examining that or of exploring the sorrow is to show how that sorrow finds another form, which is in some way beneficial. I don't know if that's the way it strikes me, beneficial. It isn't happy for Tita, but it produces sort of out in its extension. The effects of those meals are wonderful, freeing. In fact, she does free Gertrudis. I don't know, we don't really know for what, eventually. Each year Tita prepared it, this is on the last page, each year Tita prepared it in tribute to her sister's liberation, and she always took special care in arranging the garnish. And this is only one of the episodes in which the effects of the meal are either love, passion, freedom for other people, not ever for herself. That there is a kind of her life is totally vicariously given for the sake of others. There's a passage at the top of 26. Starts actually just in the previous column. She felt so lost and lonely. One last chili and walnut sauce left on the platter after a fancy dinner couldn't feel any worse than she did. How many times had she eaten one of those treats standing by herself in the kitchen rather than let it be thrown away? When nobody eats the last chili on the plate, it's usually because none of them wants to look like a glutton, so even though they'd really like to devour it, they don't have the nerve to take it. It was as if they were rejecting that stuffed pepper which contains every imaginable flavor, sweet as candied citron, juicy as a pomegranate. Did you hear the Eve of St. Agnes there? Mm-hmm. With the bit of pepper and the subtlety of walnuts, that marvelous Chilean walnut sauce. Within it lies the secret of love, but it will never be penetrated, and all because it wouldn't be proper. Another identification of Tita herself with the food that she has made or is making. The one who is rejected, though she herself contains every imaginable flavor, she has within her the secret of love, which is never expressible to other people in any way other than the food that she cooks. Tita's at the bottom of the first page, the column on page 23. there's a comment about Rosara's meal, and she can't cook. She has not got any love in her. I think there's a sort of an implicit equation here that loving people can cook. But Rosara doesn't. I mean, she's just as bad at cooking as she is at making love. So she's ignorant of that and many other gastronomical secrets. When Tita tried nicely to give her some advice, Rosara became irritated and asked Tita to leave her alone in the kitchen. So they have a terrible meal, which makes everyone sick. But at the bottom of that column, that had been a tragedy, but nothing like the one that shook the ranch this time. Tita's blood and the roses from Pedro proved quite an explosive combination. And of course they do. This meal results in this wonderful scene with the naked woman running across the fields and being swept up on the horse by the outlaw, or by the member of the militia, the rebels on his horse, and wildly making love on this galloping horse, while Tita stands left behind, not able to experience any of what her production has brought forth or called up. All the love that is in her has produced all this fire and passion, but she has only been a kind of vehicle for it. That's not quite right either. She's more than a vehicle. Other things about this passage?
I thought it was interesting the way she had to explain away what had happened, that the militia had set fire to the end of the house and kidnapped Gertruda. And, she tries to pacify everybody, satisfy everybody, make everybody happy. Which is an impossible task. But through her love and her cooking, she weaves magic in some lives. And Gertrude was one of them. But I saw the movie, and I love the scene where the outhouse bursts into flame. I mean, it was great.
I still have that pleasure to look forward to. I have not seen the film yet, and I want to. So that I think that this last paragraph in this section, which follows the little thing in which she believes that if she could just look up to the stars, and if Gertrudis was looking at the star also, this sense of this love, this communicative love, would move back and forth between them. But even that she can't achieve or accomplish. Even that is denied to her. That was her dream, but the longer she scanned the stars in the sky one by one, the less she felt the tiniest bit of warmth. Just the opposite happened. Shivering, she went back to bed. Convinced that Gertrudis was sound asleep, her eyes shut tight, and that's why the experiment hadn't worked. So pulling up the bedspread, which by then had to be folded in thirds, she looked over the recipe she had written to see if she had forgotten anything, and added, "Today, while we were eating this dish, Gertrudis ran away," which is this kind of very simple and reduced, prosaic way of trying of talking about what it is that happened, this marvelous explosion of passion in the most powerfully romantic and erotic vision. And Tita is not able either to experience that, or when she writes it down, it's as though it has stopped being what it was and has become just some something with all of that passion stripped out of it. I think there are wonderful reverberations throughout that whole text about the meaning of food and the preparation of food and the effects of the feast on the people who are eating it. And there are probably lots of wonderful connections that you could draw between this text, pieces of this text, and Babette, where certainly that sense of the healing power of the meal. I would say that in this section from Like Water for Chocolate, it may be, I'm not sure how that fits in a healing designation. It certainly is, it's called Liberating for Gertrudis. But no thing that happens in the book, I think, heals Tita. She's only the mechanism for the healing of others.
She's squashed totally, you know, when this Rosura has cooked this terrible meal. And then the mother says, what a wonderful meal. Wouldn't you say it was good for the... No, she said...
for a first time.
The first meal, it isn't bad. Don't you agree, Pedro? And then Pedro has to reassure the mother that, okay, it isn't so bad for the first time. But of course, it was bad.
Yes, and that this happens all the way through the book. I mean, I think this is only an example of the suffering that this character does. And it would be really interesting to, you know, if one is studying the book as a whole, to talk about whether that suffering is tragic or whether it becomes or is used in a way that is redemptive, and thus not tragic or kind of anti-tragic. It certainly, she is a character who is pitiable because her suffering is so terrific and all-consuming. I think we are led up to that suffering again and again and again in the book. It's kind of a huge weight that is piled on that one character. That kind of suffering is also, of course, the main topic of Beloved, and I will probably have to get to that another evening. I'm sure there are a couple of other categories under which this section that I have chosen would fit, and there may be others. There may be those of you who know Beloved better than I do who could find other passages. The passage that I will want to concentrate on that I have reproduced here is pretty oblique in reference to feasting, I think, but I would like to make a case for it, but we'll probably have to do that another time since it's time for this session to be over. So thank you for your contributions. And I hope to see some of you again.